This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
They say that tougher gun laws do not decrease gun violence. We call BS!
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. In the weeks since the shooting in Parkland, Florida, the push for gun control in this country has gained momentum at an astonishing pace. Students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School pressured Florida lawmakers into passing the first significant gun regulation bill that state has seen in decades. And seemingly overnight, they threw together a national movement known as Never Again, which recently gathered hundreds of thousands of protesters across the country in the event billed as March for Our Lives.
6 minutes and about 20 seconds. In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered. Everyone who was there understands.
Emma Gonzalez, a survivor of the Parkland attack, very quickly became one of the most visible leaders of the new movement. She's instantly recognizable. When we see her in public, she's got her army green jacket covered in patches, her head is shaved, her voice is stalwart, and she is absolutely fierce. In the last 2 months, Gonzalez has debated an NRA spokesman on live TV and faced down a wave of trolling attacks from extremists. One video that went viral compared her activism to the Hitler Youth, all of which is a lot to bear for a high school senior who wasn't old enough to vote in the last election. Emma, I barely know where to begin, but what I'd like to know is what your life was like the day before the shootings. What were your days filled with? What were you dreaming of? What did you worry about?
Yeah. So before this all happened, my main concerns were, how can I, like, my shirt doesn't really fit. How can I tailor this better? You know, like, I was very into clothing modifications. I have this old hoodie that my brother had. It was like, it was an extra large. It was too big for all of the people in the family to wear. So I cut it in half, and then I cut other little strips into it, and I re-sewed the strips so it looks all like kind of punk, but not really. It looks cool, and I embroidered a lot of patches onto my patch jacket, which I actually wore at the march because I figured, you know, it's iconic. So like mainly watching Netflix was a big concern.
What do you watch on Netflix?
Oh, what don't I watch on Netflix? I watch a lot of movies. We're a big movie family. We had a whole summer where it was like, now Emma's old enough to watch all the movies that were previously inappropriate. Let's show her everything that now she's old enough to watch. And it was like, it was the summer of Young Frankenstein. It was the summer of Death to Smoochie. It was a good time, you know?
Tell me a little bit about your family.
My family, I have two older brothers. I have two parents. My dad is Cuban. My mom is from Virginia. Mm-hmm. I got my older brothers. One of them is living in New York. He's fully grown. Another is in college ahead of me. And I'm going into college. And I'm very excited about that. We're a very loosey-goosey type of family. Like, our main conversations are just movie quotes.
You know, when people see you behind a microphone or at a demonstration, they look at you and they think this person must have been a very political person, as even as a kid, you know, as a teenager. Was that the case?
I would like to think that it was, because especially after the last election, I mean, I was always like understandable of how the way the world works, because in ninth grade, that was when I fully came out. So like, I was very aware of all of the things that could possibly go wrong for someone who is of the LGBT plus community.
Sure. As a political issue, did guns come up among your friends before the shootings?
They did a little bit. We had conversations in class about guns. Like when the Las Vegas shooting happened, we were talking about it in class for, I think, like the whole period. Watching the Las Vegas shooting happen was horrible. That never should have happened. It was definitely something that all of us were like, this is a huge problem. Like, bump stocks are terrible. Why don't they ban them? And then, like, you know, everybody was talking about banning bump stocks, but then they never did. And
Emma, this is a difficult question, I'm sure, but tell me about the way your day began on February 14th. Tell me where you were and when you either heard or saw the first signs of trouble at school.
That was a silver day for me. We have silver days and burgundy days because those are our school colors. And on silver days, I have astronomy, then I have study hall, then I have AP Gov, and then I have English. But during the day, during both lunches, I was doing something for GSA, Gay Straight Alliance. It was a table in the middle of the courtyard where everybody eats lunch. We were handing out proclamations of love. Because, you know, they're basically like little free Valentine's Day cards that you can give to people. But it looks like an official piece of paper that's like, I proclaim my love to thee, ha ha. And it was a really cute thing. And it was just a way to like spread the love. And some people were like, oh, cool, I love this. I'm going to give this to the person I hate the most and who hates me the most. And I'm like, oh, frenemies. You know, like I didn't really care who took it so long as people were spreading the love. And you could use them if you wanted to, like, propose to someone and fake marry them. Like, it was all good fun and in the name of love. And it was actually kind of funny because later we visited the school on the Sunday after because we had to regroup. And someone came up to me and said, hey, Emma, I just wanted you to know that proclamation of love was the last time I got to say I love you to my friend before she died. So, wow. So I just want to tell you thank you for giving us that opportunity. And I was thinking about that the day of. I was like, how many people did we sign off those proclamations to, and they were able to give them to their friends before they died? And someone actually came up to me and told me that, and that was wild. But after we finished up the table, I had been sitting out in the sun for about 3 hours straight. So we went to the auditorium, and my teacher printed off an attendance sheet to make sure none of us left the auditorium, because, you know, sometimes we would be able to sneak off and stuff, but this time, for some reason, she doesn't even know why to this day, she just was consumed with the thought, like, perfect, I'll print off an attendance sheet, nobody will be able to ditch the class. And my friend and I were actually going to leave and go to one of our favorite teachers who was on the third floor of the freshman building, and that was one of the classes that got hit pretty hard, and if my teacher hadn't printed off the attendance sheet, we would have been there, which is something to think about.
Emma, it's pretty known that when people in the world lose somebody, they lose friends, they lose relatives, the first period right after, the immediate mourning period, there's a lot to do. There's a lot of commotion. There's friends come over with food. There's the funeral to arrange. There's this, that, and the other thing. That it really sinks in, either the loneliness or the sense of loss comes a bit later. A bit later has now come. We're now in springtime, and this happened in mid-February. I wonder how you and your friends are processing and experiencing the losses that you did now as opposed to 6 weeks ago.
I mean, I don't speak for everybody else in the movement, but I know for a fact that, like, usually nowadays, just the thought of Carmen is enough to overwhelm me.
Tell me about Carmen.
Carmen Shentrup was, she was in the freshman building, and she was killed on that day. And we were good friends. We were on the bus together. We were even on the bus sometimes the same day as the shooter. I knew his bus stop, and hers was, like, right before his. So, feels weird to think about that. And it's not, you know, like, there's always the mix of, oh, it's good to remember those things that are a part of that person's life, but it's also sad to remember that they're not going to continue being that person, that their picture is never going to actually age. It's going to be that picture for the rest of your life, not theirs. But aside from that, it's just mainly like we know that we're pushing for these changes for these people. Us personally, as a part of March for Our Lives, we are connected to the people who are lost in our hometown, so we are fighting for them first and foremost. We are also fighting for those who are lost every day due to this. We have friends now that we know their whole lives have been turned upside down by gun violence. We're fighting for everyone who's been affected by this, but, you know, we all have those, we all have our own reasons for fighting these battles, and very selfishly, a lot of us in the movement, we pull them first and foremost in our own minds.
Your mother said something amazing about you. She said, this is your mother, Beth. It's like she built herself a pair of wings out of balsa wood and duct tape and jumped off a building, and we're just like running along beneath her with a net, which she doesn't want or think that she needs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that?
I remember that line. I think that is kind of true. Although I'd like to think, you know, as a mother, she's a little bit more worried about my precarious position than I am, because as a brazen, naive adult, young adult, I'd like to think I don't have to wear shoes when I'm walking on a paved road. There's no glass here. Stomp, stomp. But, you know, like I'm very assured in where I am in my life, and I know what is and what isn't from what I've seen, but there are many people who know more about what I don't know because they've seen a lot more and they're older and wiser.
Now, you are right in the center of, and you and your friends are right in the center of a political argument that is, on the one hand, incredibly moving and has moved a lot of people to the streets and into some form of political action or another, but you've had a big taste of how immovable most politicians are, particularly in the Republican Party, but not only, when it comes to guns. What are your real hopes and expectations, and what are your frustrations now that you're encountering real-life politicians in a political battle?
Honestly, encountering those politicians that are very stubborn when it comes to what their beliefs are, what their voting issues are, if they don't reflect what the majority of their constituents are calling for, just makes them that much easier to vote out of office. It's kind of refreshing to see someone who really won't move, because then you can say, well, their opponent will probably move, and then you talk to their opponent and it turns out they will move, and now you know who to vote for or something like that.
But you live in the state of Florida. Are you pretty confident mm-hmm. that on the basis of this issue, somebody like Marco Rubio is going to get voted out?
Yeah, no, we're going to very hopefully vote him out the next presidential election, because he's a disaster. He never listens to anybody. We have a game in my house called Marco Rubio instead of Marco Polo, because, you know, you can't find him because he's never in office. You call him and he's not there. And then you go to his office and he's not there. And you send him a letter and he never answers back. He's just one. That's exactly what should not happen, and the fact that it's a disaster.
Now, you've been attacked in the media and by the NRA pretty hard, and there have been fake photos mm-hmm. of you that have been distributed online. One of them has you, I think, tearing up either the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. I
yeah,
saw.
Yeah, they on whitewashed me in that one.
Yeah,
it's funny.
So, what's your favorite attack? But how does it overall make you feel?
I don't really know if I have a favorite one. They're all so weak, like. You know, there's, as far as I know, for me personally, there's been the crisis actor attack that, like, I'm a child actress who shaved her head. But the Constitution one is really funny because, like, I don't know, like, they whitewashed me and they gave me, like, they made my eyes, like the skin around my eyes look really dark as though I was really tired. Like, that was just funny. And like, I don't know, they're really weak attacks. I don't think I could actually have a favorite because like, there'd actually have to be a good one. But they're all really weak.
Emma, I think the march in Washington and the marches that occurred all over the country were among the most moving and important political events in this country in a long time. And then the next day comes. How does the movement mm-hmm. get sustained when inevitably, your classmates are going to begin to separate? Some people are going to get more interested in other things. Political movements are very, very hard to sustain, especially when they're flying in the face of really, really strong opposition. Mm-hmm. How does this go forward?
Well, in terms of people getting pulled apart, I don't really know if that's going to happen here because a tragedy brought us together. And, you know, what happened in Parkland was the beginning of getting everybody to listen. And the march was the beginning of the storytelling. And now we're going around and everybody's going to be directly confronting the people who have the direct say in this. And that would be the representatives. We're going to be doing letter writing campaigns, like Letters for Our Lives and, you know, town halls. We're going to be giving interviews. We're going to be not just us, but the people involved, like people all around the country. Like, I love the kids that we met from Chicago. They're some of the most wonderful people. And we're going to be like lifelong friends, I can tell. It's just they deal with a completely different type of violence almost. You know, they lose 17 people on a good week. It's so important that we get these people's voices heard because they're the people who we should be fighting for the most because they deal with it the most. People wonder how, you know, like they're like, you guys are the generation that has the shortest attention span or whatever. And it's like, well, yeah, but we also know how to keep people's attention on us because we're teenagers and we have the phones.
You have the phones. Mm-hmm. Emma, thank you so much. I thank you for a lot more than just this interview, you and your friends.
Thank you so much.
Emma Gonzalez is a senior at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, in Washington, it seems as if the Trump administration is going to take the hardest line possible with, among other things, Iran. Trump was critical of President Obama's nuclear deal with Iran from the very beginning. But you don't appoint a man like John Bolton, a vocal and very aggressive advocate for preemptive strikes, unless you want to make people very, very nervous. Now, that hard line is being received with absolute joy in Saudi Arabia, which is a bitter enemy of Iran and its chief rival in the Middle East. Staff writer Dexter Filkins has been reporting on Saudi Arabia under its new ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. MBS represents a huge change in that country. He's young, he's seen as a reformer, and he's working overtime to change the way that Americans think about Saudi Arabia. Dexter Filkins is recently back from Riyadh, and we started out talking about a magazine that we'd found at Walmart, all of its glossy pages dedicated to the greater glory of MBS. So, Dexter, I've got in my hands, before we have a serious conversation about Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia, I've got this publication, this magazine, that sells for a mere $13.99 on the newsstand called The New Kingdom. And apparently, this is a publication put out by the folks at American Media, the people who do the National Enquirer and much else. What is this? Look at this.
Yeah, it looks like a superhero comic book. You know, Boy King transforms universe. And there's this very flattering photo of him. And at the bottom of every page, it says the Magic Kingdom, which I guess is referring to...
It's a little Disney-ish,
to the Magic Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
What's amazing as I flip through this magazine is that there are just beautiful pictures of, you know, windmills and falconry and women getting together. It's like a fantasy of what Saudi Arabia is or could be.
Well, I think they're trying to sell MBS as the savior of Saudi Arabia, and this is what the kingdom could be. And as many people put it to me, this guy's going to be king for 50 years, and this is the Saudi Arabia that he wants. And so he's kind of turning the big aircraft carrier in another direction.
So MBS is just in the United States, and he met a tremendous number of people, whether they're in politics or business, and it clearly is a huge diplomatic and PR effort going on. Who is MBS, and why is he different from the King of Saudi Arabia and his predecessors?
Well, he's the crown prince, so he's the next in line to become king. And as somebody put it to me, an American diplomat, we're used to, you know, when we get on the phone with the King of Saudi Arabia, he's 85 years old and he's kind of half asleep and he mumbles a lot. And then the phone call's over. And this guy talks, you know, he's engaged.
He's 32 years old.
He's 32 years old. He's ambitious. He's impatient. He's charming. He's charismatic. He's tall. He's on the make.
So even as crown prince, MBS has been making some liberalizing moves. He's promised to overhaul the Saudi economy. He's lifted restrictions, including women driving. Is he offering real reform?
Yes, but it's important to distinguish what kind of reforms it definitely wants to open up the economy. There's a lot of economic reforms that he's initiated. He's trying to restrain the clergy. He's letting women drive. The one thing that's not on the table is political reform. This is all about saving the House of Saud
and maintaining power. So what is the economic predicament of Saudi Arabia?
It's pretty dire.
We think of them as just magnificently wealthy,
and they are. But they're burning cash at an extraordinary rate, and it's a vast welfare state where almost everything is subsidized from food to gasoline to education to healthcare, housing. But what's happening is that the whole economy was built on the idea that oil would be about $100 a barrel. It's about $60 right now. And so they're just basically burning through their savings. And so as somebody put it to me in the story, at current trends, in 5 to 7 years, Saudi Arabia is broke. They're running out of money.
Unless they do what? Because I don't expect that in 5 to 7 years, the petro economy will disappear.
It won't disappear, but they can't sustain what they have. They don't export anything else. They import virtually everything else. So they've got to diversify. They got to do something else.
Now, MBS has also talked about inspiring a Saudi entertainment industry. I don't normally think of Riyadh as a kind of proto-Hollywood or New York or Paris in that way.
It's amazing. He's doing it. Movie theaters, concerts, you know, with certain restraints, but he's doing it.
So Tom Friedman at the New York Times came back from doing an interview with MBS in Riyadh, and he wrote an extremely enthusiastic column, said he was rooting for him. And he got some pushback for this on human rights, on any number of issues. And Friedman appeared at the Brookings Institute, and he'd been asked whether he had been kind of foolhardy to be too optimistic about MBS's rule. And here was Friedman's response.
I got news for you. The entire Arab world is dysfunctional right now. And so when I see someone having the balls to take on the religious component of that, to take on the economic component, to take on the with all of his flaws, okay, that I want to invest just a little. I just want to stick my head up and say, God, I hope you succeed. And when you do that, the holy hell comes down on you. Okay, well, that, okay, is my view. Okay, so.
What do you think? Do you agree with Friedman?
Yes and no. I mean, he's right about, okay, we got somebody in here who wants to, like, change it up. And all power to him. I think the problem with that kind of unbridled enthusiasm is it ignores the kind of darker side of what's happening.
Well, let's get into the darker side of what's happening. Where are the main areas?
So, in addition to all these things that he's done, at the very same time, he's arrested human rights leaders. He's detained journalists.
There's not going to be freedom of speech.
Absolutely not. I mean, that's just off the table, and in many ways he's tougher than his predecessor. So he's clamping down on any kind of notion of political reform at the same time. And then of course we have the famous now wave of arrests when he dragged in dozens of very wealthy Saudis, even some of his relatives.
But he put them in that well known prison, the Ritz-Carlton, which was
yes.
A very peculiar thing, no?
Very peculiar. I mean, the you know, it's a hotel for princes. It's just not generally for princes under arrest.
And maybe the main thing that happened at the Ritz-Carlton is that MBS forced any number of these people to give up either all of their assets or billions of dollars, tremendous amounts of assets, all in the name of anti-corruption. How is that done and toward what political end?
Well, you know, some of these were the richest people in the world. We're suddenly locked up in the Ritz-Carlton. And so as best we understand it, when they were sitting in their hotel rooms from which the doors had been removed and anything that could be used to harm themselves, they were interrogated and their financial documents were kind of laid out in front of them. And they negotiated and arrived at a figure. And it usually, as I understand, it wasn't all of their money. It was some of it. So you're worth $2 billion, we get a billion. And so it was kind of agreed to, and then you signed that away. Everybody kind of shook hands, and then no one spoke about it when they came out. They didn't want anything really bad to happen to them.
Did anything bad happen to them?
It looks like it.
What happened?
There's at least one person who died in custody, it looks like under pretty grim circumstances. But at the end of the day, MBS got $100 billion from in the big shakedown.
The Saudi government got $100 billion from it. Wow. Your piece seems to imply that MBS has been making deals with the United States, and the Trumps are pleased to be making these deals for two reasons. One for geopolitical reasons, and the other is for potentially for personal reasons, so this is more difficult to ferret out.
Yes.
Let's start with geopolitical. In the Obama administration attempted to create a kind of detente or better to say a balance of powers in the region by dealing with Iran, signing a nuclear deal, dealing with it in all the complexity that you have to deal with Iran. Now you have the Trump administration, which sees a pure friend in Saudi Arabia and a pure enemy in Iran.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, the Trump administration came in and said, this whole thing about sharing the neighborhood, which is what Obama said to the Saudis, share it. We're tearing that up. And we're going to go after Iran. And so, you know, the Iranians have essentially come to dominate, as they see it, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. They're everywhere. They're on the march. And we are going to roll them back. And I heard that phrase many times talking to people in the Trump administration, roll back the Iranians. And so in the past year, what have we seen? The Saudis and the Emiratis essentially tried to overthrow the government in Qatar. They think Qatar is too close to Iran. They tried to essentially overthrow the government in Lebanon. And then they launched this, you know, enormous and very bloody bombing campaign in Yemen, intervening in the civil war there because they see the Iranians as essentially behind
it. Which the United States assists in.
Yes, I mean
on the Saudi side.
Yeah, I mean the Obama White House kind of held their nose and said, "Okay, we'll keep sending you the bombs to drop," but they really didn't like it. And the Trump administration said, "Just you know, go to it."
Dexter, you've explained the geopolitical reasons why the Trumps are going to be close to MBS and have been. There's also the personal aspect, the personal financial aspect to it. How would you break that down?
Well, this is complicated, but both the Trump and the Kushner families have financial interests in the Middle East.
So Qatar, which is home to a key American airbase, is currently the target of a blockade. Probably not by coincidence, but you tell me. Your reporting turned up evidence of a failed real estate deal between the Qataris and the Kushner family. What happened? And it seems to be a factor in the administration's attitude toward the blockade of Qatar.
All this is just remarkable. I'm shaking my head. The Kushner Companies owns the big high rise
666 Fifth Avenue,
and that has a mortgage of $1 billion, more than $1 billion, that's coming due soon. As I was told by a very credible source in the financial industry, the Kushner Companies in April 2017 came to the Qataris in the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan.
Looking for cash.
Looking for $1 billion. They asked for $1 billion.
As one does.
Yeah, as one does. They had a big plan to kind of renovate the building and kind of make it all work. And the Qataris, they have a sovereign wealth fund with $300 billion in it. They have money to burn. They looked at the deal that Kushner had kind of laid out for them, Charles Kushner, Jared's father, and said, you know, forget it. Thanks very much, but no thanks. 6 weeks later, there's a blockade announced on Qatar.
John Bolton's going to be national security advisor very soon. How do his priorities and record square with MBS?
This is going to be a very unpredictable period. I think John Bolton is on. I think he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times a few years ago, essentially calling for preemptive strikes against Iran. That's just exactly the sort of thing that MBS is thinking.
MBS compares the Iranian leadership to Hitler.
Yes, I had these conversations when I was in Riyadh. They said it's the Nazi ideology, and they do not merely want to dominate the Gulf. They want to destroy Saudi Arabia and conquer Saudi Arabia, and we are – it's no more Mr. Nice Guy. And so instead of what you had, I think, in the Obama administration was they were essentially restraining the Saudis from – getting into some kind of serious, maybe a shooting match with the Iranians in the Gulf. Now it's a completely different ballgame. I mean, now essentially, I think with Bolton and even to a certain extent with Mike Pompeo, the new Secretary of State, they're going to be going after the Iranians.
Do you think the Iranian nuclear deal is done?
Maybe. My sense is they want the Iranians to cry uncle. I mean, they're looking for a reason to back away from it.
Dexter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave.
That was Dexter Filkins, a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can find his piece on MBS, the Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman, and everything Dexter has written for us at newyorker.com. And that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. I bet you had no idea we were on Twitter, but you know what? We are at New Yorker Radio. So stay in touch, and we'll see you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Cal Alia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, Sarah Nix, Mithili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.